So first I'm going to discourage you a little bit. I'll give you a little bit of a downer. See if this works. Well, let me give you the overview. I'm going to go through it first, the problem, the central problem that I believe is facing modern biological sciences and medicine, or even science in general, which is a problem of complexity. So this is the downer part. We all read in the newspapers every day how about these magnificent advances in the Human Genome Project and in discovery of a gene for everything. There's a gene for opera appreciation, you know. or the newspapers would have you believe that. And they're always, this is going to be the cure for something, which is kind of an advertisement, and people are, of course, selling their own research. But the problem is that it often hasn't worked out. And the reason, or the paradox of modern biology, is that we know so much about the pieces of biological systems that we still aren't very good at putting it all together in these fully assembled, interactive networks, systems. And so the paradox is that the so-called reductionist paradigm, which has worked brilliantly for several hundred years, is to understand the pieces of systems down to the subatomic particles of physics, moving up through chemistry, through biochemistry, organic chemistry, biochemistry, just like students take in college, ultimately with biology and then medicine, and then public health, and then society. So, you know, bigger and bigger. But the problem is that the pieces don't necessarily predict the whole. Indeed, this has been a serious problem, and probably you don't know about this, but this is not a good era for drug discovery. You probably think we're making all these new drugs. Terrible time for new drugs. The worst time in the last 30 years, right now. This is despite the Genome Project, fabulous research advances in basic biology, fewer new drugs last year than in 10 or 20 years. And the pipeline is going dry, not the opposite. This is contrary to what we had thought would happen. I don't say we. I would say they, because I didn't believe it. But what had been sold was that we're going to get more and more targets, we're going to get more and more drugs, and this is going to be a renaissance. And the system for drug discovery is instructive. So for those of you who don't know, I'll give you some background in all these areas just so you can learn something from this talk, even if you don't believe a word I say otherwise. So this is how drug discovery works now. It's called target-based drug discovery. You use genomics or genetics or basic biochemistry, and you come up with a molecule that might be a target for disease. This protein might be involved in Alzheimer's disease or something like that. And then you get that protein in a test tube, you get an assay for it, and you screen a million chemicals against it. It's called high-throughput screening. This is a great step. You can literally screen a library of chemicals. So companies own a million chemicals, and they just throw it against it, and they find 10 of them or 50 of them or 2 of them or whatever that interact with this molecule. And then they go with that, and they do what's called combinatorial chemistry. They just add all kinds of stuff to it, and they find a molecule of a derivative that interacts better. So this is industrialized discovery. That's the idea of it. Very efficient. Take advantage. It's smarter. We're not smart enough to know what molecules work, so we'll just take the advantage of numbers. And then you end up with drugs that interact with these targets, and they're going to treat the disease. And so these companies get a drug like this, and they go public, and they make a lot of money. But they never get drugs. They just get molecules. Why is that? So the problem has been that we have way more and more targets and fewer and fewer drugs. 98% of these drugs, really, it's way more than that. Even 98% of the ones that go into trials fail. It's called attrition. So we have this huge failure rate. Now, why do we have a failure rate? It's not really a surprise. Failure rate is because, this is shown schematically here. The failure rate is if you look at a drug acting on a molecule, that's not really the target, is it? The target is some complicated flow through a network that's way out there, very distal, very difficult to predict. So how do you solve that problem of interactions between all these components, and where does your target fit in the living brain, the living body, whatever it happens to be? So this has been really an unanswered question. In fact, I love this quote from Lewis Thomas. Some of you may remember him. He wrote books about 20 or 30 years ago, Lives of the Cell, a very, very elegant medical writer. And he has this quote, which is in his style. And I'll read it to you. He says, "It is essentially impossible to just step in and fix a complex social system like an urban center or a hamster. If there are things you are dissatisfied with and anxious to fix, you cannot set about fixing them with much hope of helping. This realization is one of the sore discouragements of our century. Whatever you propose to do based on common sense will almost inevitably make matters worse than better. You cannot meddle, so this title, this chapter was called On Meddling. You cannot meddle with one part of a complex system from the outside without setting off disastrous events that you hadn't counted on in other remote parts. Intervening is a way of causing trouble. So if any of us believe that, we wouldn't be in medicine, drug development, public health, because it means just hands off. So we don't believe that, but how do we get around it? You can't understand these things in trivial, oversimplified models, and that may be what you're saying. So what is the answer to this? And so this is a lead-in to there must be a solution, and indeed there is, because we in everyday life navigate complexity. And my favorite example is shown here, is how do you drive through traffic? There is no computer program, actually, that can drive a bus or a car through traffic. That's why you have no automated driverless vehicles. But my 17-year-old, now 18-year-old daughter learned how to drive a car very nicely. So what did she have that a computer doesn't have? And the short answer is vision. So any person can see the pedestrian when they're in the sidewalk, can see the tree and the curb, and not hit them. So that's called feedback. You see something in real time, and you can use an accelerator, a brake, and a steering wheel. That's all you need. But the main thing is vision, or what's in systems theory, it's called observability, which is in the actual system, you observe what's going on, and you feedback. So that's a simple notion, intuitive notion, of how you navigate through complexity. In other words, you don't have to know, that you don't have to predict the ambulatory behavior of every pedestrian in San Francisco and Berkeley before you get on the road. That's what sort of modern biology would say. Let's calculate it out here. No, you just don't hit them when they're in the crosswalk. Well, yeah, or in Berkeley, you just actually don't drive near the campus. So that's the other one. But so anyway, this was called, it's interesting, the derivation. You've heard of the term cybernetics, right? Everybody thinks of that as a computer term. It wasn't designed as a computer term. It was designed by Norbert Wiener, who was looking at he developed this term cybernetics, which is the study of automated control or robotic control, automatic control of systems. And it's from the Greek word kybernos, which is the helmsman, the person who sits on the ship and drives the ship, the helmsman. So that's the idea, he said. What is the essence of control is to be in the driver's seat and to see where you're going. So why don't we do that in medicine? Why don't we just take a drug? So what I showed you before is you take a hit and you close your eyes and hope that it gets you a disease cure. That's a terrible way to do it, and that's sort of how we do it now. So the trick then, what my research has always been, is how do you navigate through complexity by seeing where you're going? Very simple, by trying to see where we're going. And in biology and biochemistry, we are blessed. That's why I'm not in sociology, sorry. But is that we are blessed by having the actual pathways of biochemistry to guide us through these enormously complex systems. Biological systems are orders of magnitude more complex than anything a physicist has ever studied. None of the rules of physicists really apply to the higher levels of interactive control in biology. And the same is true for politics and sociology. But the reason I'm not in those and I'm in this is that you can actually get your hands on something and measure it and then guide yourself. Well, that's the short reason. Anyway. So the idea here is, again, so this is all by way of introduction. I'll give you some examples. The idea is here, you take a biochemical pathway, and what a pathway does, it catalyzes the flow of molecules. So that's why we call this moving pictures. Molecules flow through this pathway. That's what these enzymes and proteins and genes are doing. That's what they're doing, making something functional happen. So we measure that as the link between a gene and a disease, or a protein and a condition. So why hasn't this been done before? And again, that's the art. That's the technologies for measuring motion pictures are different than everything else in contemporary biochemistry. For those of you who know anything about biology, there's, you can measure either immunoassays and gene expression arrays and PCR and all these tools you have in biochemistry. They don't tell you where a molecule's been, how long it's been there, where it's going. They are static. It's like the difference between a snapshot and a motion picture, just a different technology. And so this required new technology. So that's what we've been working on for the last 20 years. And I'll give you a few examples. And again, I won't teach this, but we use instruments called mass spectrometers, which are big, fancy instruments, but very powerful at detecting safe, non-radioactive isotopes. So we give these tracers and trace them as they flow through the body without giving any radioactivity. So it's a great technical advance that allows all this to be done. But again, I don't want to make this technical. I want to keep this interesting for everybody. So let me give you an example of how you can look at dynamics or flow in a complicated condition. And this is, again, if anybody's interested in this, please feel free to ask, because I know people may have personal stakes in these kind of things. So there's a disease called CLL, chronic lymphocytic leukemia. It's the most common leukemia in adults, actually the most common leukemia in the world. And it has the strange part about it is there's really two kinds of CLL. Some people have a very benign form where they just get a lot of CLL cells in their blood, and then it doesn't do anything to them. They die with it. Others die of it, which is to say it's aggressive and can progress to disease and dysfunction in a couple of years. It can be a very aggressive disease. And the problem has been there's no way to tell who's got the aggressive one and who's got the benign form of this disease. So you can't treat everybody as though they have the aggressive one, because then you're unnecessarily... And that's been actually tried. They said, okay, let's just treat everybody so we can get the bad ones. And you end up getting worse survival rates than if you did nothing. Because what you did is you exposed a lot of people who otherwise would have done fine to toxic drugs. And so that's the first rule of medicine, primum non nocere. First of all, don't hurt, don't harm. So we're stuck. We're in the rock hard place, too much, too little. Because we can't tell who's got what. So we asked one more bit of background is that CLL is a very slow developing disease in some patients. So the model was these cells are just not dying. That's why they're accumulating. It's a failure of cells to die. So everybody thought if you were to measure the turnover, the proliferation and death of these cells, they would just be a constant slow rate and they don't die. So we said, well, let's do that. Let's see if that's wrong or right. And we found a big surprise. So we had a technology for measuring the birth and death rate of CLL cells in people. No toxicity. We could measure it pretty easily in a number of people. So we did this. And we found, and I'll just walk you through this a little bit. So maybe this is not showing so well. But so these are three patients with stable disease. These guys are not getting sick. And you can tell that here are their counts. And you can see how flat they are. They have the same, this is time, and this is count. So they have the same cell counts over a couple of years. They're not getting sicker. And what we found is, this is now how many new cells they develop over time. This is our new technology. We find that they don't make a lot of cells. These lines are very low. And you can't read this, but they make 10% of cells in 12 weeks. Now that means 1% of new cells every week. This is a really low number. They're hardly making any new CLL cells. So then we found people, and this is just three examples, but we have many others, three people with bad disease. Their counts are going up, and they have to get treated, stuff like that. And we found that they're making cells like crazy. Huge number of new cells. Nobody ever expected a CLL patient could make so many new cells. There's a big, big surprise in the field. Because of the cell culture work, it suggested the cells weren't dying, but you look in the body, they're growing like crazy in some people. So this is 50% new cells. It's not working. This is 50 or 60% new cells in 12 weeks. So nobody had ever thought you could make double your population in a few months. Yeah.
Was the death rate the same?
No, in fact, you can see that here. So here's the death rate. If you stop, we label for this time and then we stop. These guys, they don't really die, right? They stick around. So here, these guys are starting to die. So they're making cells and they're dying. So you couldn't tell that was happening because it's a dynamic process. It's like, what's an example? It's like traffic going across the bridge. You could take a snapshot of the Bay Bridge and say, well, there's 1,000 cars on the bridge. And that tells you nothing. If the traffic reporter in the morning said, oh, there are 2,000 cars on the Bay Bridge. You'd say, give me something useful. Is the traffic moving? Right? Like, or if they said, if the plumber said, yeah, there's a couple thousand gallons in your pipes there. And you said, no, I want to know why the toilet won't flush. Right? So you need to know motion. And this is what we didn't know. We knew there's a 100,000 CLL cells. But in one person, they're making 50,000 cells every 3 months. In another person, they're making 2,000 cells. So why do you care? Well, it turns out that if you're making a lot of new cells, these cells undergo genetic damage, and they increasingly select more and more aggressive clones. And then these clones grow faster, and then those get selective. That's called clonal expansion. And they end up with a very aggressive disease. Normally, you don't have a tumor. You don't have CLL. You just have L, lymphocytes. And you have it's about a few percent. It's about actually 0.4%. We just did this about 0.5% a day, so 3% a week, let's say. So it's faster than these guys and slower than these guys.
Might this technique be applicable to a current clinical problem which we're facing in our practice? I'm a neuroradiologist. Can we apply MRI and spectroscopy perfusion and PET scanning to imaging patients who've had glioma surgery for brain tumors? And one issue is sometimes you can have recurrent lesions, but you don't know if they're tumor radiation necrosis. And it turns out even with our fanciest tools, our prediction rate of which sometimes isn't that good.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if any of these techniques which look at cell growth kinetics might be helpful.
Yeah, so let me just summarize that for the people who maybe didn't hear. So the question was, in neuroradiology, there's a glioma disease, and sometimes the growth... The question was, would these tools be helpful in determining whether cells at the margin of a tumor are there from the treatment or are recurrence of disease, as I understand it? So actually, yeah, we've looked at that. We haven't actually done it with the glioma cells, but we have looked at other cancers with this, and the same idea applies. The dynamics of the cell may tell you information that you couldn't otherwise get from looking at. So I'd be happy to talk about that. We are actually quite actively involved in using this in other tumors, solid tumors as well. But the point here, this is easy to do because this is blood. CLL you can get out of the blood. So that was why we did this one. But the point here was it was a big surprise that no one had anticipated, and it actually changes our whole view of the disease. We published this in a good journal last year, and the editorial with it was that maybe everybody with CLL has a failure of cells to die, and then when you get the cells that are hyperproliferating, then you're in trouble. So we're testing this in a big $4 million and National Cancer Institute trial to see if this predicts who progresses with disease. So this is an example of kinetics in diagnostics. Now let me give you one that's really, really fun, and I think this was mentioned in the handout. It's one of my favorite areas.